Good morning.
Good morning, Council.
May it please the Court. The National Labor Relations Act imposes an affirmative obligation on both employers and unions to bargain in good faith. This case arises out of the employer and union's attempt to negotiate a successor labor contract. The issue in this case is whether the board's finding that the union did not engage in conditional bargaining during those contract negotiations is entitled to deference. PPG submits that it is not, because the record evidence viewed as a whole shows that the union engaged in unlawful conditional bargaining. Even though it went through the motions of contract negotiations for 19 days with the employer, the proof of the union's unlawful conduct is set forth in the testimony of its chief negotiator, Mr. Mezzo, the testimony of the company's chief negotiator, Mr. Martawanek, and the union's written contract proposals and communications. Specifically, Mr. Mezzo, the union's negotiator, at trial testified that the purpose of the union's conditional bargaining position was to avoid bargaining over the company's proposal to reduce wages at that time, to forestall the ability of the employer to unilaterally dictate any resolution by at least a year or two, and to only permit wage concessions that the union found acceptable during that round of contract negotiations. That testimony by Mr. Mezzo is corroborated by the company's negotiator, who also testified about the party's contract negotiations. Mr. Martawanek testified at trial without contradiction that Mr. Mezzo told him that if the union decided that the party's discussions concerning the economic concessions that the company was seeking resulted in a package that the union found unacceptable, the union was reserving the right to refuse to bargain further. The union's position, as communicated to the company, is also reflected in its contract proposals that it submitted during the course of negotiations, as well as its written communication to the company outlining its provisional bargaining position. Each of the union's economic proposals indicated that it was completely provisional. That's significant because it made no distinction between proposals that the union contended were made in a timely fashion or an untimely fashion. In the same way, the union's announcement to the company of its provisional bargaining position did not seek to differentiate between proposals it contended were made in a timely fashion or an untimely fashion. Rather, the union's correspondence to the company says that the union would provisionally discuss any matter raised by the company, again, not distinguishing between proposals that were allegedly timely or untimely.
Any matter after a certain date, wasn't it? Or before a certain date?
There were the initial position, I believe, Your Honor, the union took in negotiations was, we're not going to talk to you about proposals that arise after this date. But its written communications do not draw that distinction. It says we're going to provisionally discuss any matter. And the economic proposals that it communicated to the company didn't distinguish between timely or untimely economic proposals.
And in fact, all of the economic proposals arose after that date, which was June 1, I think.
Actually, that's not correct, Your Honor.
Is that the union's, the board's position?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is that the board's position, though? That all of the economic proposals came in late?
No, it did not make that determination, Your Honor. And we accepted to the ALJ's determination. Well, the ALJ didn't really address the issue specifically as well, though he noted that prior to June 1 and on June 1, the employer had communicated economic proposals to the unions, a $10 reduction in labor costs in a two-tier wage system. And at trial, Mr. Mezzo admitted that he knew as of June 1st that PPG was proposing a two-tier wage structure that included new employees and laid off employees in the second tier. And when he was asked at trial, what economic proposals are you contending were not timely made? He doesn't reference two-tier wages or $10 reductions in wages. He mentions health care, vacation, holiday pay, funeral pay, and jury pay. So the union admitted at trial that there were some economic proposals that had been made in a timely fashion, but its provisional proposals did not distinguish between wage cuts and the other items that Mr. Mezzo contended he could bargain provisionally over. In the face of this evidence, The board articulated three bases for its decision to dismiss the general counsel's complaint. We would suggest, in light of the evidence I've just outlined, those findings are entitled to no deference. First, the board found that because the union regularly met with the company, made concessions, the union acted consistent with the Act's good faith bargaining obligations. However, this court and the board have long recognized that simply going through the motions or engaging in conduct that looks like good faith bargaining does not necessarily satisfy a party's obligation to bargain in good faith.
Well, how can you tell? And they're there for 19 days, they're going their proposal, or 19 sessions, their proposals back and forth that are made, and the board says that constituted good faith. How can we sit here and say, no, no, that actually was not in good faith?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in this case, we have the benefit of the union's testimony as to what the purpose of its conditional bargaining position was. And they admitted at trial that it had a purpose that was inconsistent with good faith bargaining. So when you're looking at refusal to bargain cases, it is not unusual for the board to look at conduct that's made away from the bargaining table as indicia of bad faith, along with what in fact happens at the table. And in fact, there are many cases where the parties engage in long, long negotiations and that the parties are making concessions, and the board nonetheless finds that there's bad faith, not because of the shortness of the negotiations, but in fact because the employer is on the side telling the union or telling the employees, we can stay here as long as we want, we're never going to agree to this, or we're just going to try and wait till the union gives up and walks away, and the board has used that to find bad faith.
The linchpin of your bad faith claim is the idea that the union was saying it's provisional, but the board found that the union was simply preserving its rights by saying that. And
yes, Your Honor, but it is one thing to say, to file a grievance and let the grievance process play out, but you cannot keep hanging that over the head of the company and saying, look, if this turns out to be something that's not acceptable to me, I'm reserving the right to bargain further, which is what the union's position was. And they had a choice to make here. They could have taken the position that the contract rolled over and said, we have a new contract, we have no obligation to bargain. Or, as the union and WWR did, they can say, I am here to bargain unconditionally. I have this grievance over here, and that will play out, and it will tell us whatever it tells us if and when it's resolved. But to interject the conditions that the union placed in this case on the negotiations by appending it to all of the proposals, by admitting at trial that it reserved the right to walk away if it found what was going on unacceptable, shows that this was not simply the preservation of a litigation position, but shows that it had a broader purpose. And in fact, again, because they did not seek to distinguish between proposals that were made in a timely fashion and an untimely fashion, even at the bargaining table, there is evidence that the union was not simply reserving its position with respect to those economic proposals that it contended were made in an untimely fashion. The board also found a violation in this case because it claimed there was no evidence that the union stance actually affected negotiations. But no board precedent requires that bad faith be so scientifically quantified. It's for exactly the reasons we were discussing a moment ago. Because bad faith is so difficult to measure, that it placing conditions on negotiations can be found to be bad faith. And to accept the premise the board articulates is to offer protection to employers and unions who end up being bad at bargaining in bad faith. Under the board's logic, as long as the tactics do not, quote unquote, actually affect negotiations, no violation of the duty to bargain in good faith will be found. But no harm, no foul exception exists under board precedent, nor would that be consistent with the affirmative obligation the statute imposes on employers and unions to come to the bargaining table with an open mind and a sincere desire to reach agreement. Finally, and as Judge Kavanaugh, you mentioned ago, the union did, in fact, file a grievance, and we do not dispute their ability to seek a determination from an arbitrator that certain proposals may have been made in an untimely fashion. But again, the conduct of placing a provisional label on all of their economic proposals belies the idea that they were simply trying to preserve their position with respect to those limited proposals that they contend were made in an untimely basis. All of these points we submit shows the board's decision is not entitled to any deference. This court has clearly held that the board cannot obtain this court's deference simply by relying upon a selective reading of the record. And I see I've taken up my initial time. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Barbara Sheehy for the National Labor Relations Board. I just have a couple of points that I want to make. One of the first things I want to clear up is the ALJ actually did make a finding that there were no economic proposals proposed on the first day of negotiations. So, and I think we tried to make this point in the brief, and I think there's some confusion. But if you look at Appendix 3, Joint Appendix page 3, which is the ALJ decision, the board decision with the ALJ following, it says PPG did not present specific wage proposals for the union on June 1. Instead, it presented and discussed with the union proposals that all parties characterize as non-economic. Additionally, there's other evidence in the record. On Joint Appendix page 388, which is the tab marker for a binder of all the proposals that were sort of passing back and forth. If you look at page 388, the tab 1, it's a little funny on the reprint, I think, but if you see tab 1, those were labeled as the company's non-economic proposals dated June 1, 2009. So just to clear up, I'm not, and the caveat that the union did put on the top of the proposals was restricted to any of those that involved economic proposals. The caveat does not appear, for instance, on any of the union's proposals as they related to holiday pay, grievance, arbitration matters, the lead person, shift changes, successor language. And those are found at Appendix 390 through 96 and then Appendix 398. So again, the caveat just appears on a proposal as it related to wage or where it was a mixed proposal. I think there are three instances where the caveat is in the record. One, I believe, is a mixed proposal where the bulk of the proposal is a wage proposal, and then there, I think, is a non-economic there. So the proviso appears at the top. And on top of that, the proviso, as Judge Ginsburg recognized, is clear. It says there it's a provisional proposal that relates to any proposal made after June 1, 2009. So to the extent, then, that the caveat was on a proposal that was sort of the banner on a proposal, if there was anything in there that was proposed before June 1, 2009, by the very language of the caveat itself, the union's provisional statement didn't apply.
On page 3A3, could you point out the passage you were discussing?
I'm sorry.
Where on page 3 does the ALJ say what said whatever he said?
It's the second column, the second full paragraph. Starts with PPG did not present.
Okay.
and then I wanted, excuse me, I wanted to also address the issue of the company seems to concede, again, an argument here, that had the union done what the union did in WWOR, things would have been okay. That the union in that case said we're bargaining unequivocally and unconditionally. But if you look a little closer at what the union did in that case, while they made those statements and they went to the table, they tried to go to the table and continue to bargain, what they did say was all of their proposals after that point in time, even when they said we are bargaining unequivocally and unconditionally, the union consistently made it clear that that statement was subject to its right to pursue the grievance. So in that case, it was no different. While the union in that case chose to use different words than the union did here, what you had in effect was exactly the same thing you have here. You might have had more repetition on the part of the union here. They chose to put it on every proposal, but the conduct was no different. The union in both cases said, we will bargain with you subject to our right to pursue the grievance. And I think what we also want to point out here is that even unlike the union in that case, I believe in WWOR, the union and the employer ultimately didn't continue bargaining. Unlike what the union did here, you have tentative agreements reached on a deletion of the stock option plan, a deletion of several memorandums of agreement, a change in the complaint procedure in the arbitration. The parties agreed on that. The parties agreed on funeral pay. The parties agreed on procedures governing something called open arrow occupations. They agreed on how to modify the shift trades. These are all found in the appendix. All the tentative agreements are at 403 through 438 of the appendix. And you also have, I think what company counsel didn't highlight for you was testimony from the chief negotiator for the company who stated that the union, specifically as it related to wage proposals, the union was moving in the direction the company needed to see movement. In fact, I think the record testimony is not only that the union was moving in the direction of the wage proposals that the company needed, the reduction in cost per labor hour, but that the company's proposal, the opening proposal,
was not very different at all from its closing proposal in September when sort of negotiations fell apart. So what you have, in fact, is 19 bargaining sessions, counter proposals by the union, tentative agreements reached by both parties, an acknowledgement by the company's chief negotiator that the union was moving in that direction, all against the backdrop of the company actually not moving very far off its own opening proposal. And then you have the company saying, in that circumstance, the union has engaged in bad faith. We would submit that the board's finding that the union engaged in good faith bargaining should be upheld. And I think there was only one, make sure I've just said everything. One last point on the point about the company counsel made about how the board highlighted that the conduct has to actually affect the negotiations. I think in response to that, I'd ask the court to look at the entire board decision in this case. That wasn't the underpinning of the case. The board correctly undertook the analysis, which is a totality of the circumstances approach, looked at all the circumstances. They highlighted the conduct at the bargaining, the various agreements that were reached, the conduct by the parties, the proposals, the concessions. Additionally, they noted, as another element of its decision, the board noted that there was no testimony that the conduct actually affected negotiations as they related to the union's ability to engage in good faith bargaining while still protecting a right to pursue a grievance. And then thirdly, there was an additional factor, which was that the union agreed to expedite, with the company's agreement, agreed to expedite the arbitration and actually pursue that on a quicker pace than was provided for in the party's agreement. And unless there are any further questions, I think that's all I have.
Record reflect when that arbitration was completed?
The record reflects when it was scheduled to occur, which was October 2009. But the record doesn't. I don't believe the record. The arbitration decision certainly isn't in the record, but it was scheduled. And as far as I know, there's nothing to indicate that it didn't occur in October 2009. Thank you very much. We'd ask for the board's order, or the board's dismissal of the charge to be enforced. Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Shaw on behalf of Intervenor United Steelworkers. The union's statement that it would bargain provisionally over certain contested subjects did not impose any conditions on the parties' negotiations. It didn't delay negotiations, and it didn't frustrate bargaining. The union was simply expressing to the company that it should not interpret the union's proposals and counterproposals over contested subjects as a waiver of its grievance regarding the contractually appropriate subjects of bargaining. The union took the position that we have a reasonable grievance that we need to resolve, but we still are engaging in bargaining over all subjects raised by the company in order to achieve a contract. The board law on this issue is clear. A union may reserve its right to pursue a grievance regarding the contractually appropriate subjects of bargaining while simultaneously engaging in good faith over those subjects, which is what the board found the union's conduct demonstrated. The Act does not require either party to use specific words to describe its bargaining intent. It requires that the parties meet with a sincere intent to reach agreement. And there's no evidence in support of the company's contention that the union's use of the word provisional somehow tainted the entire course of the party's bargaining. To the contrary, the record provides ample support for the union negotiator Michael Mezzo's credited statement that the union's proposals were no different than they would have been if they had not been submitted with this provisional proviso. The substantial evidence in this case shows that the union did bargain in good faith with an open mind and a sincere intent to reach agreement, and bargained over all subjects, including the contested subjects. The union's conduct had the hallmarks of good faith bargaining, including meeting with the company on 19 occasions. The union and the company reached numerous tentative agreements, and most importantly, the union made significant movement towards the company's bargaining position and agreed to substantial economic concessions. Some of those include the union's proposal of a 3-year wage freeze. The union agreed to the introduction of a 2-tier system with dramatically lower wages and benefits for second-tier employees. The union agreed to increase premiums and deductibles in the employee health care plan, and the union agreed to the entire elimination of the defined benefit plan for employees. There's no evidence that by pursuing its grievance, the union intended to or did in fact delay bargaining. On receiving the company's late introduced proposals, the union immediately filed a grievance, notified the company as to its position, agreed to expedite the grievance to arbitration and notified the company that it would abide by the arbitrator's decision and not seek appeal of that decision. The union didn't refuse to bargain over any contested subjects. The substantial evidence supports the board's finding that the union invoked the grievance procedure purely to obtain a ruling from the arbitrator as to the contractually appropriate subjects, while at the same time engaging in substantial good faith bargaining with the company with the intent to reach an agreement. If there are no questions, the union rests.
Okay, thank you.
The general counsel quoted part of what the ALJ found. In fact, just above the passage that she cited to Judge Ginsburg, the ALJ found that on June 1, the first day of negotiations, Ms. Mortaronic reiterated PPG's intention of getting down to $27 cost per labor hour. He made it clear there would be a second-tier wage. And he goes on to say whether Mortaronic specifically stated it or not, the union was aware from the May 28 email that PPG would ask for wage concessions from current employees to reach $27 an hour. Now, he does go on to say that they made no specific wage rate proposals on June 1, but I don't think it's accurate to characterize that or selectively quote the finding. There were economic...
But the contract, pardon me, contract called for submission of proposals, right? Topics to be discussed.
It says proposed changes or new agreements shall be presented not later than the first day. And the proposed change was to reduce wages by $27 an hour and to propose a two-tier wage system. And Mr. Moore...
But it wasn't really to go right to $27, was it? Tomorrow? Sorry. Was it a meet to go immediately to $27?
They wanted to bring wages down by $10 per hour.
And would that hit 27 immediately?
Yes.
So it was 37 to 27.
Yes, it was.
In year one.
Over the course of the agreement.
Yeah. Right. So saying that they wanted to reach $27 an hour isn't exactly a proposal. It's rather vague.
Well, if you
it's a topic.
It is admittedly less specific than saying we want a two-tier wage system.
How could you bargain over someone saying we want to reach $27 an hour eventually?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a lot of ways to do that. There's some fairly draconian ways, but I think one of the things that Mr. Mortaronic proposed and testified was that they gave contract language to the union on the first day of negotiations that...
Which was untimely.
I'm sorry?
Wasn't that untimely? It was supposed to be 10 days before.
No, Your Honor, on June 1, the first day of negotiations, Mr. Mortaronic gave contract language that outlined the two-tier wage proposal.
I understand that, but what did the contract call for? CBA, didn't it call for submission of proposals 10 days in advance, something like that?
It says with respect to proposals, it says they should be presented not later than the first day of the conference by the party serving notice.
Oh, at the actual meeting. Oh, wait a minute, by the party serving notice.
Yes, the company served notice to terminate. The first contract negotiation was agreed to be June 1.
So it's the notice to terminate that had to be earlier.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. You. So June 1 is the date that is relevant. Mr. Mortaronic gives them contract language that shows how they intend to have a two-tier wage system. So I don't think it's accurate to suggest that there were no economic proposals made prior to the first day of negotiations. The only other point I would make is as to the litany of agreements that the union made, that evidence is largely a red herring when you consider the testimony of the union negotiator at trial. He was asked, so the only way to reach an agreement, the only way for the employer to be able to implement wage concessions is if the union agrees to them. And he said, correct. That is not unconditional bargaining.
But are you arguing that we should look at what they said and not what they did?
I think you should look at both, Your Honor. You should consider any agreements the parties purportedly reached at the table, any proposals they purportedly reached at the table, along with the testimony of their negotiator as to what he was intending to accomplish during those negotiations. Board cases routinely look beyond the actual conduct at the table to determine whether, in fact, there's been good faith. And we think that the board couldn't just look at what happened at the table, just like we can't just ask you to look at the testimony at trial. But viewing all of that evidence as a whole, we believe leads to the conclusion that there was unlawful conditional bargaining.
But if Mezzo says, we're trying to stall, we don't really want to do this, but they, in fact, negotiate and reach agreement, then isn't the agreement dispositive, even though he said something different?
Well, they didn't reach a final agreement, and his testimony was, essentially, I can pick up my marbles and go home when I want. I'm going to stick around and see whether there's something here that's acceptable, but Mr. Martirosyan testified without dispute that he reserved his right to refuse to bargain further. So you can reach all the agreements you want with this union, and they're telling you that if we, at the end of the day, decide we don't like it, we're going to reserve the right to refuse to bargain. That is the antithesis of good faith bargaining.
Could they do that even if they lost the grievance? You know, in other words, what they said was it's provisional because we think you didn't present it to us in time. But they also agreed to abide by that, right? So if they were making agreements and if they would be bound if they lost this grievance.
Assuming they lost, correct, Your Honor. But again, at the time that they were taking these positions, there was no indication one way or the other as to whether the grievance had been resolved in their favor or was going to require them to reach agreement. And so they had a choice. They could either bargain unconditionally or refuse to bargain and say, we've got a new agreement. They couldn't try and have it both ways by labeling every economic proposal as provisional, even though they admitted at trial that they recognized that certain of these economic proposals had been made in a timely fashion. If there's no other questions, we'd ask that the board's order not be enforced. Thank you.
Thank you.